Thanks for coming along tonight, both in the audience here and our Zoom followers and those who will watch this on television or some other means later on. Welcome tonight for our discussion with Joe Hildebrand and Warren Mundine on the concept of the voice, two arguments. We don't do official debates here, but we do have discussions with people presenting different points of view, and that's what we'll have tonight. So we're going to lead off with Joe Hildebrand. He's well known as a Daily Telegraph columnist, as a Sky News contributor, and as a presenter on occasions on and a commentator on other occasions on 2GB in Sydney. And Warren Mundine is very well known, but I'll introduce him as director of the Indigenous Forum at the Centre for Independent Studies and chairman and managing director of the, how do I pronounce that, Warren? Plack Group. How do I pronounce it? Oh, yeah. He says his CV is 4 pages long. He doesn't know what's in it.
CEO and chairman.
CEO and chairman, yeah, okay, all right. And so we'll commence with Joe, and then we'll go to Warren, and then we'll go to questions and discussion. Joe, you're very welcome. Who makes a welcome first appearance at the Institute? Warren's been here on a number of occasions. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you very much, Jared. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. I have been here before, but in a spectator's capacity, so it's lovely to experience it on this side of the microphone. I'm glad it's not a knockdown, drag 'em out debate because, as you can probably already guess, Warren and I are extremely good friends. I absolutely love the man, and he loves me even more. We actually agree with each other on virtually everything to do with Indigenous affairs, and I'll come to that sort of where perhaps we differ on the voice very shortly. I would just like to acknowledge, no, not that, but the fact that it is deeply ironic that you have a white fella up here arguing for the voice and a black fella is about to argue against it. I would also note that, as a lot of you will know, Jared is Warren's father-in-law, so I'm already, I think, at a great advantage. I suppose first principles and why the need for a voice, why I think it will be effective or at least is worth a shot. And again, I think Warren and I see the problems almost exactly the same way. I think we just see what the voice would be or could be very differently. Obviously, there was a debate launched by Prime Minister Tony Abbott with the support of the Labor Party about constitutional recognition. Indeed, it wasn't even a debate, it was a push. Tony Abbott was for constitutional recognition. And that process led to the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And long story short, when we asked Indigenous Australians what they wanted in terms of constitutional recognition, they didn't really give us the answer we wanted them to give us. They said, we want a voice to Parliament. And I think a lot of people, Malcolm Turnbull included, said, hang on a minute, that wasn't part of the discussion, that wasn't in the brief. We were just going to put a nice little flowery form of words in the Constitution and that was meant to be enough. So the first dilemma, I suppose, you get when it comes to the voice is you can't consult with people, ask Indigenous people what they want, and then when they come back with something different to what you're expecting, say, oh, no, sorry, you can't have that. So it's a bit like Henry Ford, you know, you can have any colour as long as it's black. So I think that is the first thing. So you have to acknowledge that this is something that they have asked for and that they wanted after a process that was launched by a former Prime Minister who I think most of us very much respect, even if he, of course, doesn't support the voice in this form either. So that is the first thing. So there has been a process, whether you supported the process or not, it was a process initiated by a Conservative PM and it produced a result after years and years and years of consultation, and that is what Indigenous people on the whole want. Obviously, they're not a monolithic group and it would be outrageously racist to suggest that all Indigenous people thought the same way or supported the voice. Clearly they don't, but that was what the process produced. I initially did share some concerns about the voice being a third chamber, but I have had those concerns utterly, they've been utterly disabused of me. The voice will be, if anything, it's deliberately designed to be powerless. As we know, the form of words, or powerless in terms of legislative power, the form of words that's already been put out there might not be the final form of words, that it will be an advisory body only and that Parliament will be in all ways sovereign. And I'll maybe come back to a form of words that could help make that even clearer later on. But the more I've thought about it and the more I've been involved in the campaign or spoken to the people who are directly involved in the campaign, I've actually come to realise that we were the fools in the first place. We were the fools when we were talking about just having constitutional recognition and that being enough. And again, if you look at the situation, which I'm sure is front of mind for anyone on this issue right now, look at the situation in Alice Springs, which I'm very familiar with, and having been there myself and seen the town camps and also perhaps quite famously been attacked in the streets of Alice Springs. What we asked them to do, what we asked Indigenous people to do, was to actually come up with something that was, in fact, entirely symbolic, that was, in fact, the ultimate form of foundational virtue signalling in our national document. What they came back with was something that just said, no, there's no point having that unless we have an actual practical instrument that can fix the problems, that can close the gap. I'm sure I don't need to tell any of you how big and how chasmic the gap is. I think it's probably one of the widest, if not the widest, gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people anywhere in the world. Life expectancy alone is about 10 years or so. We also know that we throw enormous amounts of money on this problem, as Warren rightly observed on Q&A a few years ago, and people couldn't believe it. They actually, someone, you know, the dirty little hipsters tried to fact check him, and he was absolutely correct. I think it was it $33 billion, the figure that was put around? Now, that is a huge amount of money, and if you're spending that amount of money and not only is the gap not narrowing but in many cases widening, then clearly whatever we are doing at the moment isn't working. So just from the outset, I suppose, there's about three major things there. One, this is what the process produced and what was asked for. Two, it actually is a practical solution. Now, whether it works or not and whether it's a silver bullet, I don't think anyone's expecting a silver bullet that will fix all the problems at once. But they have asked for not just symbolism, but practical action. And three, of course, what we are doing now simply isn't working. And again, Alice Springs is proof of that. Alice Springs, and again, you can say, well, they shouldn't have lifted the booze bans. I think that's perfectly legitimate in terms of the acute crisis they're facing. Yes, we should send in the army. Okay, again, perfectly legitimate in terms of the acute crisis, the kids roaming the streets, looking for fights, attacking people, attacking property, because it's actually safer on the streets than it is at home. And if you'd seen some of these homes, you could see that with your own eyes. And yes, that does need an acute response. No form of words, no advisory body is going to fix what's happening in Alice Springs right now. But the idea that sending in the army is a long-term solution for any Australian community, even one as crisis-plagued as some of the remote communities and town camps in remote and regional Australia, it's clearly not a long-term solution. Saying that you're banned from drinking alcohol, you're banned from even having alcohol in your town, in your community, forever and ever and ever, that is clearly not a long-term solution, because you're very quickly getting into a situation where there are, in fact, two different rules for two different types of Australian. And that gets to the argument where people say, oh, the voice will just create a racial divide, or it will create two sets of rights for two sets of people in Australia based on race. That divide is already there. And again, you can see it in the news in Alice Springs. You can see it in the fact that Aboriginal people die 10 years earlier on average than the rest of us. So the idea that the voice would create a racial divide, there's already a racial divide in Australia that is far, far more profound and far more literally vital and deadly at the same time than anything the voice could or couldn't be. So again, far from what's happening in Alice Springs being an argument against the creation of a voice, so what are we talking about a voice for when we should be talking about what's happening in Alice Springs? Well, surely that is proof that what we are doing now is not working and that we need to try something else. If anyone has any better ideas, I'm all for it, but that is the one idea that has come forward after exhaustive consultation with Indigenous people themselves. The other thing I would say, sorry about that, the other thing I would say would be a lot of people say, well, you know, Indigenous people have to take responsibility for their communities. They have to take responsibility for what's happening in their communities. I've been accused of everything under the sun. And again, I've been accused of being a horrendous racist, for example, for pointing out the outrageously high domestic violence rates in Indigenous communities, especially in remote and regional Australia, where you have hospitalisation rates for Indigenous women in some areas 30 times higher than non-Indigenous women. I believe in one area it was actually something like 80 times higher, in one particular place in WA, I think it was, from memory. So to pretend that there isn't a problem specific to these communities is simply to ignore the facts, simply to ignore the stats, not stats as presented by activists. Ironically, one of the great, I don't know how this has actually managed to happen, but one of the great disgraceful metamorphoses of the what I call the new left, or you might call it the woke left, has been to say that even to raise questions or concerns about the disadvantage that Indigenous people suffer is racist. That apparently the non-racist thing to do is to just set back, let the women and children die, and blame it all on colonialism and white oppression and white power. Well, why don't we accept that view? Why don't we actually say, all right, fine. If it's all racism, if it's all colonialism, if it's all white people making bad decisions for black people's lives, over to you. You tell us the solution, we will consult you on these laws, and obviously it will be a matter, while there will be no legislative binding or constitutionally binding requirement to follow that advice, there will obviously be a moral imperative. I think the Prime Minister said it'd be a brave government that didn't do it. More importantly, it will all be out there in the domain. So that the suggestions made by The Voice clearly will be on the public record, in the public domain. They will hopefully be coming from people in those town camps in Alice Springs, from the aunties in Wilcannia, instead of the activists on Twitter, instead of the activists on university campuses who blame everything on, you know, again, neocolonialism or intersectional theory, whatever. We say, right, we'll go to you. We'll go to you, people on the ground. The ones, I mean, it's the people on the ground in Alice Springs, for example. They're the voice that hasn't been heard. They are the people who this body is attempting to get representation from, instead of the usual suspects in the corridors of Canberra or in university tutorial rooms. So speak to them, ask them what the problem is, ask them what they think the solution is. If it's ridiculous, the Parliament doesn't have to do it. If it's something that no one's thought of before and that could actually work, okay, we'll give it a go. But if it doesn't work, well, that is that responsibility that people talk about. Say, all right, well, you want self-determination, or you want, you know, we'd say take responsibility for your own communities. You can't very much say that while at the same time saying, but we're not going to give you any instrument with which to do that. And indeed, and again, if anyone has been to any of these communities, the idea that people should just, you know, just stop drinking or stop sending your kids to, or send your kids to school, or that, you know, or just stop hitting your wife. I mean, these are communities in a complete breakdown. And again, I have seen them. I have been on a school run. I mean, even just the fact of parents having, the reason I was on the school run is because there's a bus that goes around all the local camps to take all the kids to school, because all the cars are on bricks in the front yard. There's one car on brick for about four different families. So again, there is simply not the physical, and for all the money and the resources we throw at it, there is simply not the physical infrastructure, let alone the broader infrastructure, the jobs, the schooling. I mean, once these kids get to school, that things are happening in schools that are incredible to help retain the kids, including feeding them, clothing them, providing all their needs, providing incentives to show up. But again, these are communities on a knife edge. So we need to do something to fix the problem. Nothing we have done so far has worked. This is what Indigenous people have told us they want and they need, and they've asked for a practical solution instead of a symbolic one. As Donald Trump said to the black voters of America, what have you got to lose? Vote for me. It couldn't get any worse, because under all the people who said they had your interests at heart, your lot in life has actually gotten worse. And that's what's happening here. And yes, there are, of course, historical wrongs. I don't deny that. There have been complete screw-ups in the past. I don't deny that. And there have been well-intentioned policies that have failed spectacularly. There is no question of any of that. But the point is, either we keep doing what we're doing and expecting a different result, which is Einstein's definition of insanity, or we say, all right, we've tried everything in our wheelhouse, everything we can think of, everything our institutions use. It works, you know, it might work for every other avenue of society, every other branch, every other community, but it's not working here. You're the ones living here. What do you think we should do? And if they tell us and it works, we win. And if they tell us and it doesn't work, well, the Parliament has the capacity to try something else, or indeed to ignore that advice and try something else anyway, or indeed the capacity to reconstitute or tweak the voice. And my suggestion to allay concerns that the voice would be enshrining a racial divide in the Constitution, which to some extent already exists anyway, because the previous referendum, ironically enough, gave the Commonwealth the power to make laws for Indigenous people in particular. And that was one of the great victories. 90% of us or more voted for that. So that racial divide, again, exists in the Constitution already, or that racial specification. It sounds like Terran Run. But you could just simply have a catch-all phrase in the voice that would say, and the Parliament shall have the power to dissolve and reconstitute the voice. In other words, that if it gets bedeviled by corruption, as at Sick Dig, the Parliament can say, right, you lot, you're all fired, and we're going to hold a fresh set of elections, or we're going to tweak the way that the body is made up, and then run it again and see if that works, or indeed treat change the level of representation. And that again goes to the problems of, I mean, there seems to be a weird parallel argument that's being run against it, which is that it's dangerous to have the voice enshrined in the Constitution, but if we do enshrine it in the Constitution, we have to have a really specifically detailed version of the voice set in the Constitution. And that, again, those two arguments actually cancel each other out, even though they're being run in tandem by the same people. What you actually want, and the beauty of the Australian Constitution, is it's an incredibly flexible document, unlike the American Constitution. It just provides a sort of skeleton. It basically says, here's how you elect a parliament, here's how you elect a senate, here's how you elect a House of Reps, and then you just let them figure it out. And then they can do what they want and they can sort it out. That's why we don't have a prime minister in our constitution, for example. What we have is an incredibly stable system of government that has evolved out of a document that was made to be deliberately flexible and deliberately able to change, or deliberately able to allow the government to change as needs and times required. And that is exactly what the voice can and should be as well. So you actually want it to be something that can be changed by the Parliament of the day, and therefore indirectly the people of the day, to make sure that it works and make sure it does what it is supposed to do. And I think that's probably my time. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Joe. So we've got Warren. Thanks, Warren.
As what's your name again? Sorry. As Joe said, we are good friends, and of course after this function, he's such a good friend. He's going to take me down to the whiskey bar, and we'll have a few bottles. Paid by you? Yeah, that's good. Yeah. It is ironic too, as Joe says, that you got this white fella who's standing up here for it, and I'm against it in it. But when you actually start looking back through the history and the constitutional history of Australia and the relationship between Aboriginals and the wider Australia, we have been on a journey for a number of years, and that goes right back to colonisation, right through to the setting up of the Commonwealth in 1901. And then as you go through that history, you start to see where the Australian nation was heading, and especially after the Second World War, about where it was heading. Before, when you get the late colonial period and the setting up of the Commonwealth, yes, it was a interesting gymnastic way of actually dealing with Aboriginal people, because one of the things that said in the Constitution was that if you got voting rights at the state level, you got voting rights at the Commonwealth level. And that was a bit strange, because when they had the first election, there were Aboriginal women in South Australia who had voting rights, because in South Australia, women had voting rights. In the rest of Australia, women didn't have that voting right. So the good thing that happened there, it actually, women got, and I never argue with a woman, they got pretty cheesed off. And so they said, well, how come they're voting there but we can't? So that was the changes within the Electoral Act in regard to, that getting women to vote. So we were one of the first nations in the world to achieve that. America and the UK did it decades later. As a society, we can't go past our history. We should always recognise our history. We should always talk about our history, because I'm a great believer in in history. I'm an amateur historian because I'm not a professional historian. I just love reading about history. I like researching and doing things about history. And when you, we had the interesting situation in Australia that we had a two-tiered system of citizenship rights for people. So if you were born in Western Australia and you were born in the Northern Territory and Queensland, you were in an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, you were a second-class citizen. There's no doubt about that. You didn't have voting rights. You were put on reserves and that across the country. You had very limited rights as a whole. And so, but in when you come to South Australia, Victoria, New South Wales and Tasmania, we had a number of rights which Aboriginal people could exercise, like voting rights. You know, I'm writing my book, which goes at a very reasonable price at every good bookstore. Or you want to go on Amazon online and all that type of stuff, you can do that, a Booktopia, is that we come across in the archives electoral rolls of my grandparents who were voting in 1913. So there's a lot of confusion and a lot of things that overlap in that about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander and in Australia's history. So you had this two-tiered systems. I say it's time and geography determine how you were treated. And of course, in New South Wales, even we did have voting rights. If you lived on an Aboriginal reserve, no one told you you did. So you were never able to exercise those rights. In fact, they discouraged you very much. But we were a very fortunate family living up in a cattle station where we were able to exercise those rights as a family. So as we move forward into after the Second World War, Aboriginals, prior to 1948, it's 1948 and 1949, I'm sure Jared will correct me later, is that Australian citizenship was created. Before that, we were all British subjects. And by that, having that British subject stance, we were citizens of this country prior to that. And when the Citizenship Act come into control, there was some restrictions put in place for us as Aboriginal people. But that over time shifted, and it was and despite what a lot of Labor Party people think, that it wasn't Gough Whitlam who did these reforms, it was the Menzies government. The Menzies government in 1962 gave full voting rights to Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islanders across Australia, which then forced states like Western Australia, which in 1962 gave full voting rights to Aboriginals, and then the Queenslanders, always the deep north, they always hold out. Any Queenslanders here? They held out to 1965. So when you hear all these myths, and we need to, correct this. I say if we're going to talk about our history, we've got to talk about the real history. 1967 didn't give us voting rights. 1967 didn't give us citizen rights. But what it did do was actually it pushed the agenda for equality in Australia, for all Australians, the 67 referendum. So by 1969 and 1970, all racial discrimination laws in this country were gone, kicked out. And any racial discrimination laws against Aboriginals, it's been over 52 years since they've been in place. What happened from there is there had been a huge push to deal with, okay, they are full citizens, what are we going to do? And then it was the Gorton government who came into power, and they actually gave Aboriginal, they set up the Aboriginal studies, which was to get Aboriginals support into schools and Aboriginals into support into universities. In fact, in 1969, my older brother is about 300 years older than me, in 1969, got to go to Macquarie University and do economics. So these things were slowly happening. And then as we moved forward, the school teacher principal's roles had to be changed because they could bar Aboriginal people. And if people know Neville Bonner's story in Lismore, when he turned up to school, he was barred to go to school. And so you start looking through all that history, and then you get into more modern times. And I get really I don't get upset. I just look at people and just say how stupid they are. Australia is not a racist country. We do have racists in this country, like every country in the world has. We have not had a good birth, but name me a country in the world that's had a good birth. Every country in the world, in Europe, Asia, Africa, whatever, have had a horrendous thing. I don't rate a country by its history. I rate a country how it overcomes its history, forges together and moves forward. Post-Second World War, when a whole lot of migrants come to this country, a huge amount of migrants who come to this country and made a huge difference in helping the economy, helping us move forward and doing a great job about that. I went to Catholic school. I went to school and I had 39 kids in my class, and we probably had 39 different nationalities in that class, except we probably had a lot of Italians. They used to call me Mundini because of the E on the end of my name, which I thought was quite good. It was a good pickup line for women. They thought I was Italian. But anyway, we regress. To me, we've put in place since 1973 and even in the 1960s with the coalition government, bodies that were to deal with Indigenous affairs and what way should they go and what way they should happen. It was the Whitlam government in 1973 who set up the National Aboriginal Consultative Council, and that was a group of Aboriginals who come in and wanted to do things. And then it got a little bit radical. This is what happens when you get a bunch of Aboriginals together, and they decided to declare their independence. But anyway, so after that, they had to get rid of that committee, and they got another one of the National Aboriginal Conference. And there's a whole lot of other bodies that come in. You know, about five different bodies have been over the years who have been advisory groups to government and to the parliament about having what should we be doing in Indigenous affairs. There's one body, ADSIC, that was an advisory group, but it also was different because it had a monetary control. So it was able to look at money in that. And then we had, you know, later groups that did that. The thing I had is thinking about, and Joe reminded me of it, was Einstein, he's credited with it, we'll never know if he did say it, is that, this thing about doing the same old, waiting for a different outcome. Well, when you look at it, you've got a committee, they call it the voice, but it's a committee that will be given advice to government, and it will be advisory. It won't have any legislative power, won't have any monetary power. It will just be an advisory group of people. And my first question was, well, wasn't that what we did with the other five committees that we set up over the years, or conferences or councils, as you want to do it? They were advisory groups. They, except for the ADSIC, they had no monetary powers. But all of them had no legal powers, parliamentary type powers. And so you're putting forward this idea of another committee that is an advisory committee, which is going to be the same as every other committee. But this is going to be better because we say it's going to be better. And that started raising alarm bells for me. Then I had a meeting with, I went to the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, where we listened to briefings from Tom Calmer and Marcia Langton. And when they started going through this, and you've got regionals and you've got this and you've got this, I started seeing a huge bureaucracy start forming. You had regional groups, and they had to have advisors and experts. And then you have the national group, which needs advisors and experts to work with them, and there's going to be 20 of them. And then yesterday, Noel Pearson had an interview with Patricia Carvelis, and she said that one of the questions that are raised by people is, well, when you're talking about the voice, it will only deal with issues dealing with Aboriginals. Well, the first question I paused and I said, the first question I raise, well, what doesn't affect Aboriginals? They're citizens of this country. So every law in this country affects Aboriginals, like it affects every other citizen in this country. And then I clicked the pause button off and listened to Noel, and Noel's answer was, well, taxation, other things that affect Aboriginal people. And he started going through the whole lot. And at the end of his, he finished, I was sitting there and I said, oh, well, I'll be buggered. He actually is talking about every legislation, everything that's coming forward. And if you don't believe me, you can go to Patricia Carvelis on ABC, and I know some of you will go in a heart attack trying to push that button, but you got to go there and just listen to it. And that's exactly what he said. It will have a say on everything. So what does that mean for us as a nation? It means what? Legislation's going to come up. It's going to go through the parliamentary process. It's going to go through the Aboriginal voice process, and I'm going to be about 92 years old before it's actually completed and the thing goes through. The other thing is, I have not seen anything that is going to show us the panacea. In fact, I see the opposite. What I work, I've got my own couple of businesses, I work out there, and I look at the energy industry, I look at the mining industry and a number of other things, and I see the successes that have happened in those areas. A lot of people here in Sydney wouldn't know that the mining industry is the second highest employer of Aboriginals in the country. 7,000, in fact, men and women work in the industry. You've got 2,000 businesses that work within the industry. You've got a $4 billion economy coming out of that industry and training people. You go and then you look at the IPP, which we put in place. Some handsome, good-looking chair of the Prime Minister's Advisory Council thought it all out. Man, must have been a genius. We come up with a group of people, we come up with that, where we looked at how we can develop industry and investment into Aboriginal groups. And through that process, we set up this idea of setting up a commercial, private, Indigenous businesses. In 2015, 1st of July, there's $6.2 million going to that business sector. Today, in fact, only just before Christmas, the figure was $6.7 billion industry. It is employment, things are going through the roof. And these, I know from history, looking at history, that the only way that you drag people out of poverty or get people out of poverty is through an economy. It is through jobs. The problem we had in the past, we was always putting the jobs first. We're putting the cart before, I nearly said the horse before the cart, but the cart before the horse. It's about getting small to medium businesses into regional and remote areas, getting investment into those areas, and that's what lifts people out of poverty and gets kids. It sort of becomes an umbrella, because when you're doing that, you've got to have an educated, skilled workforce. And that's where that comes from. And that's what I've been pushing for years. And we've got a good cohort of Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people working together. And we've set up investment funds and looking at entrepreneurs, Indigenous entrepreneurs, and funding their businesses. And these people are going international. And they're getting on the London Stock Exchange and the New York Stock Exchange of Australia. And this is what will make the difference. A bunch of people sitting in Canberra, which we've had for decades, talking about policies and stuff like that. Me as an Aboriginal person, I just want government to get out of the way. I want them to get out of the way, and we can start building our own communities and moving forward from there. And self-determination is, there's nothing more self-determining than an Aboriginal person, Torres Strait Islander person, running their own business, employing people and making profits. Thank you.
Thanks to Joe and Warren for two enlightening talks and for keeping to the time. So we've got till the top of the hour. I should have said at the start that some of you will know we had Senator Andrew Bragg speaking here some time ago about the Liberal case for The Voice, a book published by Connor Court, and tonight another book published by Connor Court, Beyond Belief, Rethinking the Voice to Parliament, which is edited by Warren Mundine and Peter Curti, and we've got copies for that for sale tonight. We've got a number of important...
At a reasonable price.
At a reasonable price. And we also had Warren talking on his book previously as well as tonight, yeah. And it's got a number of very interesting Australians who've put in their view on that. So the copies of that available tonight, I'm sure Warren and Peter, who's here, will be happy to sign that. And so we come to the questions and discussion.
Principle is at stake when it comes to changing the Constitution. The Whitlam government created a circumstance of sit-down money for one race of people. And I know Warren's talked about this previously, what a disadvantage it was when it was learnt that we didn't have to work anymore, we could sit down. We're now proposing that there should be another form of governance only available to Aboriginal people in this country, not everybody. And it seems to me that that combination, fiscal and governance, sounds very much like separate development. In another place, it was called apartheid. I think we should be a single country with no special role for any particular racial group.
Okay. So, Joe, you might respond to that.
Sure. I would say in normal circumstances, that is absolutely true and absolutely laudable. I don't like the idea of two different bodies governing for two different races, and I think that is fundamentally un-Australian and undemocratic. That is not what the Voice is, firstly. The Voice would simply be an advisory body. The Constitution already has powers to legislate specifically for one race of people over another. So that already exists in the Constitution. That was one of the things that was voted on in the two questions of the 67 referendum. So that's already there and the sky hasn't fallen in. And again, I think there do need to be checks and balances to make sure that whatever is happening with the Voice is working, and that if it doesn't work, or again, if it gets beset by corruption. The only thing I would say to the ATSIC thing is that it was a long time. It was a quarter of a century ago that ATSIC was sacked, and rightly so. But I think that's time enough to be able to try again. The short answer is that Aboriginal people and Indigenous groups are consulted on policy all the time already. The problem is that the same faces are being consulted, the same old talking heads are being consulted again and again and again. And every time, 90% of the time, yeah, they blame it on systemic racism or, the intersectional oppression or whatever and all this crap. And so if you actually say and one of the things I like about The Voice, without sounding too harsh, is that if you say, all right, well, you've got your voice, you can elect your own people, you can have your say, you can tell the government what it should do, and then if that doesn't work, that's on you. You can't blame it on the white fella if it's a decision that you've made or something that you've done. And it removes that... it removes that sort of fig leaf, I suppose, that often in a city or elite, Indigenous spokespeople, high-profile spokespeople, will hide behind to explain why there are these skyrocketing rates of violence, unemployment, kids not going to school, kids dropping out of school when they do go. I mean, the attendance rates are just abominable. Another round of figures came out just last week. In particular, just that real life or death thing where homes aren't safe. So it actually says, all right, over to you, and again, it goes back to that being the responsibility that they say they want, the autonomy they say they want. It's got a lot of safeguards because, in fact, it has no power whatsoever, but it will just sort of pull the rug back, I guess. But anyway.
Good. Look, I agree with everything that Joe said, except for the stuff after he said, hi, I'm Joe Hildebrand. The systemic problems we have, and look, we know the history. There was racism in the past. There's a whole lot of things, terrible things that happened in the past. The thing that I focus on now is the last 50 years and how we're moving into the future. The problem we have in these areas when you start to segregate different policy areas. So, for instance, I say now in welfare payments and that unemployment payments and so on, the Australian taxpayer is pretty generous. It's the Aussie thing. If someone falls on hard times, we'll always help them. We'll always help them get back. We should avoid race. It should be about need. We need to be focusing on need. And I'm going to do something that doesn't work in my favour here. I don't need government funding and government help because I'm okay. I'm a pretty cool guy. I live in the North Shore and and fly around and have a lot of fun.
I've been there. It's a nice joint.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but keep your swimmers on next time. Anyway, the thing is, so what we've got to focus on need. If people are falling on hard times, we need to work with them on need. The problem we have is also the politics, and some and our federation works against it sometimes. Like when I was chair of the Prime Minister's Indigenous Advisory Council for Turnbull and Abbott, I spent 95% of my day arguing with politicians and bureaucrats from state and territory level, because they're in charge of health, they're in charge of education, all these other areas. We've actually let them off the hook, because they're the ones who're supposed to be getting kids to school. They're the ones who're supposed to be providing health, medical services and all that type of stuff. So everyone focuses on Gough Whitlam. They always focus on the federal government that fix all these problems. In actual fact, we had no power. I didn't want to know the students' names. I wanted to keep it as a privacy issue. I just wanted to know if there's a community with 100 people in it, if 50 kids turned up on day one and 50 kids turned up on day two, are they the same kids? That's all I wanted to know, because we know we've got to have kids continually turning up for school. Otherwise, education becomes a waste of time. We couldn't even get that data. The states refused to give it to us, and we had no power to do anything about it. And so we've got to start focusing on what we need to do to make those changes. We need the states, territories, and the Commonwealth government working together on that data to make sure that kids are getting educated and getting to school. And also, it helps us, and this is what we did in one thing, because we sort of just used our power in the Northern Territory about, we were able to get community leaders to go to the school, check who's away from school, wasn't in our, able to go and then sit down with the parents and work with those parents about how you get to school. Not punishing them, not taking off their social welfare, whatever it is. It was actually to sit there and go, okay, you've got three kids. Three of those kids aren't going to school. How can we work with you to get those three kids to school? What is happening in your family to get that happen? We're only able to do that in the Northern Territory because they just stopped us in the states from doing that. So there's a lot of federation issues we've got to deal with, I'm really sick and tired of these committees being set up and things failing and that. I just want things done, and this is what I do. I go out there and I just get things done. I went into Arakoon. I saw a bloke who was working on the dole mowing lawns, and I saw him a few weeks later. I thought, this bloke's a bit of a goer. So I went up to him and said, if I give you 15 grand, we can set you up in a business and we can get you, and I'll get a bookkeeper to help you in your tax and everything like that. And then you can contract with the local Shire Council, the school, Commonwealth government offices, da 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 da, to do that work. And he did. And that was 5 years ago, and he's still there. He's got a business now. He's got two young blokes working with him and doing things. I just want to see action. I'm just over committees. Thank you.
I've got to the question that's come from by Zoom from Western Australia. So the Prime Minister, when he made the announcement about 6 months ago, spoke about the voice engaging in representation. And the question is this, that if the voice suggested the introduction of a levy for compensation for living on stolen land, and a report went to the Parliament, and the Parliament rejected it. In view of the recent establishment of the Pay the Rent campaign, what would the prospects be of any rejection by the Parliament if the matter went to the High Court? Now, I know it's a legal question. So the real question is representations from the voice ever likely to go to the High Court, I guess?
As you said, I'm not a lawyer, but I do work with lawyers. That's probably why I'm still out of jail. No, I do work with KCs now, not Queen's councillors, King's councillors, and a wide range of people, and also constitutional lawyers. Where they say, and this is one thing and there's a differing view, I've got to say, within the legal profession about this. Some people say it's not possible for them to go to the High Court, and there are other lawyers who say that, yes, it is possible. They can't see how you can't go to the High Court, how they're going to stop that. So we've got that differing view. that's not going to be resolved until someone actually goes to the tries to go to the High Court. So the question is, I don't know. I just can only tell you what the two viewpoints are in the legal profession.
Yeah, I would simply say that whatever happens, it will be very, very clear in what is written in the Constitution that Parliament is sovereign over the voice and that the voice's advice will be non-binding. So I don't, given the High Court's role in this sense is simply to interpret the Constitution, I don't see how it could interpret that as being the voice can tell the Parliament what to do when the form of words expressly, or the mooted form of words and whatever it will be, expressly says the exact opposite. So I think that's a bit of a...
Yeah, look, I do agree with that last bit because the lawyers on both sides do it. But they can't be a legal chamber. That's all that talk about a legal chamber is not right. But through other pressures and that, you know, we don't know until someone does it. And that's I'd love to say yes or no to it, but I don't know, and I only can take the advice of the lawyers, and there's divisions on that. And I know I would love to say, gee, I wish that happened because I could do with a bit few bucks. And
yeah, brief one for Joe. Known for years, and it hasn't been fixed. We've got the same institutions in place, presumably after the voice. Why do you think it's going to make any difference?
I think. Well, as you say, business as usual clearly is not working. And yes, we do know a lot of the problems. And in a lot of the cases, I mean, Blind Freddie can see a lot of the problems that are going on. And again, these problems are often being obfuscated by the people who are already being consulted on Indigenous issues. And again, these are the sort of people who say that, well, you cannot actually even acknowledge the fact that rates of domestic violence are higher in Indigenous and particularly remote communities. Now, if you've got someone saying, well, you can't even say that because Indigenous violence knows no boundaries, knows no postcodes, and in fact, it's domestic violence knows no boundaries, knows no postcodes, it's all about toxic masculinity, it's nothing to do with a particular community, then you're not going to solve the problem because you're simply denying that the problem exists. Now, I love Jacinta Price as well. I also love Josephine Cashman. I, in fact, worked with them on a story about a bunch of aunties from Wilcannia who were so frustrated with trying to raise the story of their of what was happening in their community with the usual powers that be, and they were just getting ignored and they were getting blocked and they were actually even laughed at by certain trendy inner city Indigenous activists, and they ended up going to Pauline Hanson because she was the only one who would take them seriously. And of course, what happens then, and I wrote the piece about it, of course, what happens then, the media ignores it and everyone just says, well, that's just Pauline, anything involving Pauline Hanson, well, must be crazy, must be wrong. No one showed up to the press conference. They were right there in Parliament House and no one came. Even NITV, even National Indigenous Television did not cover it. It was absolutely shameful. And again, I got in a blue with them about this, as I tend to do on social media. And so why didn't you even cover it? So, oh, no, it's just pulling hands, blah, blah, blah. Now imagine if they could actually raise those concerns and say, this is what we need to do in a transparent way through a democratically elected body and say, look, this is it. Ignore us now. Defy us now. You smart asses who were laughing at us then, ignore it now. Imagine if, for example, The Voice, Warren, said, we need to know what the attendance records of the schools in these communities are. Imagine if it was The Voice demanding it of that publicly, demanding of that of state and territory and federal governments. Instead of just something that was happening behind closed doors. And that I think, is the sort of thing, and again, maybe I'm ridiculously naive, but that is the sort of thing, that is how I imagine The Voice operating. I don't imagine it as being another layer of bureaucracy. I imagine it as actually cutting through the bureaucracy that's already there and replacing it.
There's a lot I agree with in what Jay is saying. And the big thing I do really want to push, we need transparency in this whole process, you know. And of course, some people are going to play politics with it, but that's just politics. But we still got to fight for improving people's lives, bringing them into the better lives, housing, education, opportunities, and getting all the opportunities that all Australians enjoy. There's no argument about that. And the only way we can get that is through transparency. We saw the problems with ADSIC, and I agree that there's a whole lot of different Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people out there now. But we need transparency in the whole system, because if we don't get that, then people are going to play fun and games.
Hi, for both of you. Looking back through history, I think this is the most confusing referendum that this country has ever produced. If you go back to the conscription debates, people knew it was either go to war or not go to war without your consent. Go to the 1951 conscription for communist dissolution. The legislation was passed. The legislation was on the table. The Republic referendum, we knew the model. And yet they all went down. This one, we don't even know what we're voting for. So how are we going to find out what we're voting for? Because I see, unless we know what we're voting for, there's no chance we'll have a voice.
Certainly it's fair to say that the left, the Yes campaign hasn't been particularly effective, to say the least, so far. It has been a bit of a dog's breakfast. And I think there has perhaps been a false sense of complacency. They've been looking at the polls and, oh, yeah, we've got 60% of people on board. And I don't know if you picked up the paper this morning, but that number is going steadily, steadily down as the confusion reigns and is allowed to reign. And again, I'm hopelessly naive and optimistic, and I am simply assuming that the No campaign is already out there on the front foot and is raising some really legitimate questions and raising some concerns and also stirring the possum a bit, and that is the dominant narrative out there, and the Yes campaign simply hasn't begun in earnest, and I'm hoping they've got some whiz bang amazing 3-point document that's going to solve all the problems. I'm not optimistic and naive enough to hold my breath, but I think, look, the simple proposition is, do you want a voice, an Indigenous voice to Parliament enshrined in the Constitution that can provide advice to the Parliament that will be non-binding, and the Parliament will have the job of setting up that voice and have all power over it? So that is the basic. There hasn't been a definite form of words yet, but that is basically the proposed form of words as to what it might look like. Now, that hasn't been solved particularly well, but that is what it is. And for people demanding more and more detail, again, simply say, I mean, if you look at Brexit or something like that, Brexit didn't ask the British people, oh, what should all these tariffs be replaced with, or what should the level be, or how should we work out our fishing quotas with Denmark or whatever. It just said, do you want to leave the European Union or not? Do you want it or not? So I think there is a case for referendum being simple and establishing what the actual will of the people is, and then we already have a body to find a way to implement that will in a workable fashion, and that's the Parliament.
A very brief response. I'm glad you brought up the Republican one, because Joe and I belong to a secret society called the Joe Hildebrand Republicans, which are too lazy to campaign for a republic. But anyway, the issues, you raise some important issues, and this is why I think the Yes campaign are backing off too much information. And it's one of these things that is... okay, that's a good political move, and we'll find out when the election's over whether it's a good or bad political move. But I understand why they're doing that. The problem I have is I've worked with a lot of these people and over 35 years, and I know a lot of these people. You know, if someone told me that Albo was going to be Prime Minister 10 years ago, I would have locked you up. So I've got to give it to him, and he's done a great job internationally. He's been out there banging for Australia. So, but in this response, I think it is a mistake, because they need to give something, because when people are looking at this whole area, they're very, very reluctant to vote for it if they don't have a little bit more of that information in regard to that. And also, it's not healthy for them, and this is where, like with Facebook banning a simple comment by saying this puts a privilege in one class of people, and they said, well, where'd you get that from? And they go, oh, we got a former justice of the High Court, and 4 barristers and SCs and KCs. And I said, well, that's a bit... So they all agreed to that. And I said, that was how you worked it. And I said, well, I can show you a couple of former justices who disagree with that. I can find several KCs and senior counsels who disagree with that. So when you're getting to that, I made this on 7:30 reporters. I nearly had a heart attack when they rang me and called me up. I'd been on there for 20 years. They said, well, you know, these are very senior people. And I said, well, look, these people I got as very senior people as well. So this idea that because of that, they then ban commercials, that, and I'm always a fighter for transparency. It starts to put in my mind, well, what are these people trying to, not that I'm a conspiracy theorist, what are they going to do after this? I worry about that. And Joe said it earlier, there are Aboriginals who support this and there's Aboriginals who don't support it, but I think the vast majority are sort of sitting in the middle, haven't really made up their mind yet. But these things don't help in the discussion. I listened to Ben Fordham the other day. It was a train wreck, and that's probably what affected the polling. And I actually felt sorry for the poor bloke at the end, Alba, because he just got smashed. So we've got to have more transparency and more conversations about what it is. Otherwise, it's not going to go anywhere.
I've got a question that could be very, very brief. Yes.
Okay. Basically, my question is, why is our Prime Minister denigrating anybody who has a different viewpoint or is asking different questions? Why do you think this is? And
so the question is, is the Prime Minister denigrating people who disagree with him?
And being political, in a sense.
Very quickly, I haven't been aware of the PM actually doing it, but I have been very vocal at some others whose names have been raised here, calling people who don't support it racist. I think that is absolutely disgraceful and counterproductive. And also the idea that you would just, and Zali Steggall saying that she would just legislate for it anyway, even if people voted against it. Again, I wrote a piece published today saying it was just an absolutely disgraceful, destructive, condescending, anti-democratic, paternalistic shocker of an idea. So, yes, I think that is where the Yes campaign can sometimes become its own worst enemy.
Yeah, look, I agree. There has been, look, you should see my social media. I've been called everything under the sun, and it would make my grandmother blush. But, Albo has, this is a nice thing to say, do, and you've got to vote for it, and it puts in mind that if you don't vote for it, then you're some sort of redneck and that. I say about the people who have racially abused me in that, I said, you're not a representative of the Yes campaign. I know people who work, like Joe and other people who work on the Yes campaign. They're decent, really good people. And this is one of the concerns I have, is that we're going to get this argument. We've got to avoid it because it's not true for a start. We're all working here for something that's better for our nation. We just have different views, and we need to do that.
I just want to do one quick question. I just should make a comment as someone chairing this meeting. I'm not aware of the Prime Minister denigrating any people who are opposing the Voice. I don't think it's happened, and I've not seen it. Just finally, can we just look at the other side of this? We'll start with Joe and end with Warren. What's the downside of a negative vote? Which is certainly possible. Most referendums end up that way in Australia. The polls are not indicating that at the moment, but if that's occurred, what are the downsides of that? Very quick responses. Yep.
I suppose for my mind, and again, it goes back to that idea of saying, all right, this is your chance. No more hiding behind the fig leaf of everyone's against us. We're all oppressed. It's not our fault. There's nothing we can do about it. It's your chance to take responsibility. So my fear is that you have a no vote, and then everything that goes wrong after that, every bad thing that happens, every riot in Alice Springs, everyone just goes, well, that's because you voted down the Voice. That's because you voted down the Voice. Whereas if the Voice gets up and there's this time to say, well, all right, what do we do about it? You seem to think that you have the answers or you know what's happening on it. You tell us what to do. And unless it's a batshit crazy idea, they'll probably do it. So again, that's what I think is the problem, that it will just end up being a catch-all excuse for everything that goes wrong and more shirking responsibility.
Yeah, that's true. But we also must respect the democratic process. I read your article. That was the second best article I read that day. There was a genius in the Australian who wrote that day too. But that's my concern, and that's why I've made it quite public that if the people of Australia want it, of course, we can't have failures anymore. and I've made the commitment that I will help and I will work to make it successful, to get things to happen. Because we cannot have this continuing argument and problems going on with Aboriginal communities. I'm just sick and tired of it. If the campaign goes down in flames, then Zali Segal's and them, and you said it quite eloquently, that was a stupid comment by them. Terrible comment. We must, whatever happens, we must accept the people's voice, so to speak, and in a liberal democracy, that's what we do.
Many thanks to both of you. Just before we go, copies of the book that Peter Curti and Warren Mundine have edited, Beyond Belief, Rethinking the Voice to Parliament. And it was a great discussion tonight, very lively, very informative. Well done, Joe.
Thank you very much, Jared.
Well done, Warren.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.